Welcome to Nerds at Church, a podcast about nerdery and the Bible. I'm Pastor Emily, and I use pronouns like they, them, theirs.
I'm Rabbi Danya Ruttenberg, and my pronouns are she and hers.
And I'm Pastor Kay, and my pronouns are she, her. Unfortunately, I was not able to be there for the interview with Rabbi Ruttenberg. I wish I could have been, but I will be joining in later on in this episode for the readings. So see you then.
In this episode, we'll discuss the 16th Sunday after Pentecost, also known as Lectionary 24 or Proper 19, which this year falls on September 17th. Check out the episode description for links to the Bible passages and other references we make in this episode. For our deep dive this week, we are diving into forgiveness, and so who better to have as a special guest but Rabbi Danya Ruttenberg, who is the author of numerous books, including On Repentance and Repair, Making Amends in an Unapologetic World, which is a winner of the National Jewish Book Award and American Library Association's Honor Medal, which comes out in paperback September 13th, which is this week as of when this podcast comes out, which is super exciting. She also serves as scholar in residence at the National Council of Jewish Women. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are excited to have you. Yeah, it's just exciting. I have heard you speak and followed you on Twitter. Well, I guess not Twitter anymore. You used to be the rabbi of Twitter, right?
Yeah.
Are you yet titled the rabbi of Blue Sky?
I don't think I want that title, honestly. I'm happy to be a rabbi on Blue Sky. There are lots of great rabbis, and there's room for all of us and their voices. There's so many great people whose voices should be loud. And yeah,
that's fair.
There were lots of great rabbis on Twitter, too. May its memory be for a blessing.
It's true. Hopefully, by the time this comes out, the podcast will be on Blue Sky. But I am in the process of shifting away from Twitter and onto Blue Sky and trying to find all of the rabbis that I followed on Twitter on Blue Sky. It's a process.
It is. It is. I keep forgetting. You know, I ran into somebody at an action recently and was like, oh, you're on Blue Sky now. Great. Yes. Okay. I'll go find you over there. We were Twitter buddies. You know, there's a lot of that happening lately, I think.
Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit different because the guy had to get a different Blue Sky handle from what my Twitter handle was because my Twitter handle had an underscore in it.
Right.
And if you just do Rev Ewing, everybody thinks that I'm just reviewing and spelled wrong. No. And so I was like, okay. But nobody had picked queer pastor yet. So I was like,
oh,
I can be queer pastor.
Right. I mean, that is the advantage of showing up on a shiny new platform is that you get to be the first in on things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of shiny new things, kind of, I'm terrible at transitions. It's because I'm non-binary. In your newest book, On Repentance and Repair, so we're talking about forgiveness, and I think a lot of times we think that forgiveness is, I'm sorry, you're forgiven, the end, and that is A, super simplistic, and B, doesn't give the full breadth and weight to the process that I think is due, but you talk about like specific steps in the process of forgiveness and reconciliation in your book. Can you give us, like, I know you literally wrote the book on it, but can you give us like an overview of kind of the steps of the process and what they mean?
Sure. So first of all, in Judaism, our emphasis is less on forgiving the harmdoer and more on the work that the perpetrator of harm has to do to take responsibility for the harm that they caused and to begin to change so that they don't continue to run around perpetrating that same harm, enacting it all over that same person or on other people or communities of people, if we want to talk about larger bodies, and to make amends to the person that they harmed. You can't undo what you did, but you can try to repair to the best of your abilities and to try to become someone different. And we do talk about forgiveness, but the interest is much more in attending to the needs of the harmed party and trying to care for them. Mm-hmm. So the book is really about the steps of tshuva is the word in Hebrew, which we usually translate as repentance, but it's not repent, bad monkey, sit in corner, feel bad. you know, Zeus, God, is angry at you, but rather, you know, the like dude with a beard deity, which is not, that's not my theology. Same. But rather, the word tshuva literally in Hebrew means answer. Mm. Like I ask you a question, a she'ela, and you give me a tshuva, an answer. And it is used, I mean, you can buy a bus ticket and get a shuv, a return ticket. Like it's about coming. Yes. It's about coming back to where you were supposed to be. It's about coming back to yourself, to God, to that place where you were, you know, when you fell off I won't say path, but you know, you caused harm. You stopped being the person you needed to be. And now it's about coming back and getting back on track.
A linguistic like connection in Greek, which is what the Christian New Testament is written in, the word used for repentance is metanoia, which is turning. And I think it's particularly interesting because of the connection of those two words, but then also the way that I have frequently interpreted that and had it interpreted for me in seminary and stuff is a turning to a new way, which I think works, but I also am now wondering if it's not a turning back, like what you're saying, right? That there are different ways that we turn, because sometimes it is that we have to turn to a new way.
Right.
But I love what you're saying about turning back to maybe your truest self,
right?
Or who you truly want to be in the world, because I don't think any of us want to cause harm, at least not when we start out as little babies, right? Like, that's not any baby's goal.
Right. That is not, you know, the essence of our humanity is not running around hurting. So our work is really, you know, as I understand it, I'll sort of open up the back of the machine, so to speak. What I'm talking about is based on Maimonides, who is a 12th century philosopher, Torah scholar. He was the physician to Sultan Saladin in Egypt. He was a workaholic. He was a very confident person. He was a genius, obviously. So Maimonides took a lot of earlier rabbinic thinking and sort of rearranged things. You know, there are all of these back and forth debates in the Talmud, which is, you know, happened in what's now Iraq in the second to fifth century, with some stuff from the land of Israel that was around the, you know, codified around 150 CE, right? After the fall of the temple, things are in chaos. We better, you know, after the last stand, the Bar Kokhba rebellion after the temple, right? Things are going south. We better codify our ideas. And then we're kicked out into Babylon. Like, we can go the full-on Jewish History 101 here. But so Maimonides took these winding debates from the Talmud and rearranged them so that you didn't need to be a Talmud scholar. You didn't need to know all of the nitty-gritty. You just needed to know what to do, how to do it, when to do it. He very confidently decided some of the answers that were not necessarily resolved on the page. And obviously a lot of his own innovations and flourishes were in there. So part of the Mishneh Torah, which is this massive body of all sort of the compendium of Jewish law, was Hilchot Tshuva, the laws of repentance, or whatever we want to translate. And when I, Danya Ruttenberg, a, you know, 21st century feminist rabbi, read his work with a victim-centric, trauma-informed lens, right, I see five stages of repentance that are there very clearly. And I really believe that when you do these five steps, it's a really clear process that can be applied to our interpersonal relationships, institutions, nations, etc. And then forgiveness is a whole other track, and there's a whole other process there. And so those are kind of two different conversations we could have.
Okay. So what are then the five steps?
So step one is confession. Own the harm that you caused. Name it without, but I'm really a nice person, but I didn't mean to, that wasn't my intention. We don't care, right? Intent is not whether or not I meant to step on your foot. I was walking around staring at my phone instead of looking where I'm going, and you are now standing there with broken toes. My intention is not relevant in this. Like, you are a person with broken foot because of me. And I need to say I was not paying attention. Whatever was going on, that I was choosing this instead of that. One of my favorite confessions is Dan Harmon, who was the showrunner for Community, when acknowledging that he sexually harassed one of his writers for a very long time, said, you know, he considered himself a feminist, but he said, you know, if I really respected women, I never would have done that. And I told myself this story, and these are the lies that I told myself in order to continue doing this. And then when she rejected me, here's another lie that I told myself, right? You own what you did. Mm-hmm. And Maimonides says it's ideally publicly, you know, it's a minimum commensurate to the harm caused, right? If you say something racist in a staff meeting, then everybody who heard that needs to, you know, the next staff meeting or on the organizational Slack or whatever, right? But it is praiseworthy to tell more people, not because we're putting you in the stocks, but because you're asking for accountability. Because real deep transformation is something that you can't do alone, and you need help. And you're saying, you guys, I'm about to be doing some really hard work. I don't want to be this person anymore, and I'm going to need some support. And again, I think I really believe every single step of this is victim-centric. It's an end to gaslighting. Yeah. That person who was harmed might be saying, did this really happen? Did I do something to, you know, am I making too big a deal out of this? Whatever, right? And so then that confession validates really important things for them and can help with that healing process. If there are people who are not believing them or taking them seriously, that can shift that dynamic, right? There are all sorts of important things that happen when the harm doer owns their harm. So that's step one.
That is so hard.
Yes.
Right? Like, I get that all of the steps are important and all of the steps are hard, but there is so much about our culture. I know as a pastor, like, I have stepped on people's toes in terms of saying something that points out harm publicly and gotten pulled off privately for making somebody look bad. Or so often we mess up, and instead of owning that harm at the same public level as we committed it, we like wait until the meeting's over, whatever, go to the person directly and say, I'm sorry, or I'm sorry I didn't speak up. And there's also the like overdoing it part, right? Where I know a situation where somebody caused harm in a semi-public space, like an interpersonal interaction, but there were other people around-ish, and then raised the stakes and told everybody there super publicly that they had done this thing, which without checking with the person they had harmed, without like that person's consent about talking about it so publicly. And like, so there's part of me that's like, yeah, it should be public. And there's also part of me that's like, but like, think about it.
Right. And that's the thing about you. The point of all of this is about repairing harm, not making yourself feel better, not getting a certain kind of catharsis. And so the question has to be at every point in the process, like, how is the person that has been harmed, person or parties or whatever, going to experience this thing? And, you know, am I doing this as an ego thing? Am I doing this to flagellate myself publicly so everybody's going to tell me how wonderful I am because I'm super
righteous?
Right, which
is what happens when you apologize on, like, Facebook publicly. Then you get, like, all the people that come back and they're like, no, but you were a good white, like, all the white people that come back and say, but no, you're a good white person. And it's like,
right. That's not it. Yeah. That's not it either. So it is tricky. But it's, you know, there has to be that humility, and you don't have to name the person. You know, you can own your harm without
outing the person as having been harmed.
The person, you know, so there's this thing that happened, and it was, you know, Plony Steed, who was, you know, who lives at 717, you know, Oak Lane. Like, no, No, yeah. We're not doxing anybody, right? That is not helping. And so it's so tricky because you have to sort through all of these layers of what am I doing? Why am I doing it? How am I going to do this with integrity? And you have to work through that story where, like, we all have this story because this is how we survive moving through the world, where we are the hero. Right? We're the good guy, right? We are the one valiantly saving the day or doing our best, trying our hardest. Mm-hmm. And when we cause harm, we have to cross that bridge over into seeing, like, today I wasn't the good guy, right? Today I was not the hero in someone else's story, right? Mm-hmm. Today somebody else is telling a story that does not involve me saving the day, rather quite the opposite. Ouch. And those Facebook confessions, those self-righteous Facebook confessions, are an attempt to try to recenter yourself as the hero, right? Without walking through that valley of humility, right? It's a way, it's a spiritual bypassing, right? It's rather than engaging deeply with why did I do the thing? What inside me, if we're talking about personal stuff, right? Not institutional or whatever, what inside me is made me think it was okay to tell that joke or made me lash out in anger or made me, you know, say that in that tone of voice or whatever. Is that my unresolved trauma? Is that my fear? Is that my, what's replicating here? And how do I deal with it? And what systems do I need to set up in order to support real transformation? And that work is hard and humbling and does not get solved when a bunch of people who are like you click, you know, the heart on social media and tell you everything's fine. That does not lead to your change and will support your doing the thing and acting out of those same unconscious places again and again and again.
Even if it's not like a conscious thing, you're getting the dopamine hits. I live in an, I'm the only non-ADHDer in my house. And so, like, we talk about dopamine. Like, that is part of our framing. So, but, like, you're getting the dopamine hits, even if that's not why you did it in the first place. But I think that the one of the things that pushes against the public apology land is the actually figuring out why you did it, right? That you talked about and that you talked about with the example of the producer. Or the showrunner,
who
like named like this is these are the things, because I do think that there is the space for a sort of public apology in even on Facebook, social media, but there's so much work that has to go into being able to do that well, and this like actually reflecting on why I did the thing I did before naming that I'm sorry I did it.
Well, and I would argue that confession and apology should be unhooked from each other, that they are not the same thing. Just own what you did. Just name it clearly without hedging, without stories about, you know, what a good person you really truly are and how this was an anomaly. Like, no, this is and we live in this kind of culture where, you know, people want to say, oh, he doesn't have a racist bone in his body. We're not x-raying you. We are all human beings. We are all victims of harm. We are all bystanders to harm. And we are all harm doers. We are all human beings. And some of the things we do are helpful. And some of the things we do are extremely not. And if we want to talk about racism, like, we all live in a white supremacist culture and we are all drinking this orange juice. Those of us with less melanin are extremely much more apt to have ingested the worst of the toxins. You know, it's not this, you can say and do harmful things and not be a terrible person, right? You can say and do harmful things and also say and do wonderful things. And that probably just means you're a human being, right?
Yeah.
And living in this world where you're either a sinner or a saint and thinking of yourself that way makes it impossible for you to take care of the other people in your world properly, right? Because if you're a sinner, then you're irredeemable, so why bother? And if you're a saint, then you didn't do anything wrong. But we're all just messy.
Yeah. The irony of your language there is that in the Lutheran tradition, we say that we are simultaneously sinner and saint.
There you go.
And so that, like, That both, like, exacerbates and alleviates the I am either or.
Right.
Because, yeah, it acknowledges, at least on a, like, theological level, which is not the same as, like, interpersonal individuals acknowledging it.
Right.
But, like, acknowledges on a theological level that every person is a harm doer and a victim of harm and a good doer is kind of, I think, how it would play out more.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, listen, I grew up with this framework, and walking the walk is I wrote the book on it, and or wrote a book on it, and it is still incredibly hard to live out in real life. It is, I've made this something of a spiritual practice, and it's still every single time I have that bout of like, I don't want to, this is hard, right? Mm-hmm. It's real. It is hard work.
Yeah.
Okay. So step one, confession. Step two, start to change, because you don't want to, the whole point is that if you keep doing the thing again and again, you're not coming back to anywhere, right? We have to get to the root of the issue. So what's going to help you move along? Do you need to hit it in therapy? Do you need to call your sponsor or rehab, right? Do you need to reevaluate the company you keep when you do toxic things? Do you need to go on a deep education journey on anti-racism or transphobia, or what is the thing or things you need to do in order to start to become someone who doesn't do that thing anymore, right? What is it? So start to do that work, and it may take the rest of your life. It may be an intensive thing for a little while. I don't know, but start, right? Start walking that process. Is two, start to change. Three, amends. Right? You harmed somebody. You created a hole in the universe, and that needs to be sewn up in some way. That doesn't mean you can undo what you did, but you know, what will help? What will make things feel more just and fair? Maybe it involves money. Maybe it involves time or labor or a use of your connections or platform. I don't know. You know, who knows is the person who was harmed, right?
Yeah.
If you make assumptions about what they need, then you're treating them like an object still. You're continuing to harm them, right? You have to treat them like a subject who has agency, who knows what they need. And again, that's whether that's an individual interpersonal thing, whether that's an institution or a nation that needs to talk about reparations, which, by the way, if we're talking about reparations, note that there are two other steps that go before reparations. If we're not changing our white supremacist systems and structures and we're just running to here's money, we're going to continue replicating the same harms again and again. Would that we could get the reparations conversation moving, you know, would that we could teach history, right? That's confession would be great, but there's amends, right? What, and sometimes the person or party that was harmed, like it's not appropriate to go to them because of the nature of the harm, or you can't because they are dead or whatever. And so there are indirect amends. You can spend the rest of your life trying to change policies in your community to be, you know, safer for future potential victims, to prevent future potential victims, or teach about this issue so that, you know, the population at large can understand and create safer world. I don't know, but there are many, many, many things a person can do towards amends, but there needs to be something. And then step four. All the way down to step four, we get apology. And it's not up in step one, because think about all of the learning and transforming you've been doing all this time.
Yeah.
Right? The emotional stuff that has to happen before you even get to the confession step, and that happens through and into the confession step. Guys, I need help. And then all of the work that's happening in the changing process. And even if it's an institution that's changing its HR policies or ditching its, you know, some of the people on its board, or even if it's this insights are flowing. And then in the amends, you go to them and you say, well, obviously I'm paying your medical bill. And they say to you, I have great medical care. That's not what I need. Actually, what I need is, and you say, oh,
okay.
Oh, I wouldn't have thought of that. That's interesting, right?
Yeah.
So by the time you get to apology, you're already a different person than you were, than the harm doer, right? And so it's coming from a different place. This is a suddenly this is a contrite heart that actually is sorry in a different way. It's you know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. there's something else happening.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because so frequently I don't know what aspect of like the cultures that I'm in really can be attributed for this, but the like expectation is that the apology leads to the change.
Mm-hmm.
In a similar way, I think that like there's my favorite promise from Jesus in the Bible is in Matthew 6, and Jesus mm-hmm. says, "Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also."
Mm-hmm.
And so frequently people misinterpret that to be figure out where my heart is and then put my money there. And that's not what Jesus is saying. Jesus is saying, if you want your heart to go there, put your money there and your heart will follow.
Hmm.
And I think like that feels parallel to me of like, do the thing and then the apology will come much more naturally.
Right.
Which is a whole different perspective and reestablishes the agency that otherwise we just want it to be, we want it to be easy. We want it yeah. to be natural because we, like you said, right? We want to be the heroes of our stories and the heroes do all the good things naturally. It's not hard for the heroes to be good. And so we want to be able to apologize and just naturally get better. And that's never been how it works.
No. And from the victim's perspective, from the harm party, you know, I'm sitting here, you just kicked me in the stomach or stepped on my feet and their broken toes mm-hmm. or whatever the insert long list of emotional equivalents to that would be. And you come up to me and you say, "I'm sorry." And I, the victim, am supposed to be like, "I forgive you." And I'm sitting here going, "Ah," you know,
really?
I can't walk. I can't do my job for the next 6 weeks because I'm in a cast. You know, I can't get around. I'm going to have mobility issues for the next while because you stepped on my feet and you said these words and you feel great about yourself and I'm limping around and nobody's taking care of me, right? The yeah. labor we expect of victims. And, you know, if we're talking about things like sexual abuse by people of power, right?
Mm-hmm.
What that model of forgiveness does, if we just say you're sorry and it's done, is it maintains the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
Assuming, you know, if harm isn't always harm by someone with more power to someone with less power, right? We're messy and we're complicated and human beings manage to hurt each other in all sorts of innovative ways. But mm-hmm. often harm happens along lines of power. And when a victim of abuse, you know, let's say, you know, by a clergy person or, you know, in a school situation or whatever, is just supposed mm-hmm. to say, "I'm sorry," or "I forgive you," after they've said, "I'm sorry," if they've said, "I'm sorry." Often we pressure victims to forgive even without that apology. Yeah. There's, you know, a friend of mine did some research, evidently around 25% of the time, after a white cop shoots an unarmed Black person, media will ask family members of the victim around the time of the shooting or a grand jury non-indictment or some other really emotional time, "Do you forgive the cop?" The cop has not apologized, right? But it's, "Do you absolve the state of this murder? Can we just let things be exactly as they are? We're not going to change anything," mm-hmm. right? We forgive the clergy person so they can go back to work and continue doing whatever they're going to continue doing to the next person. Right? Yeah. It maintains the status quo. Yeah. But if we say, "No, right, you have to do the work. You have to own what you did. You have mm-hmm. to change. We're not satisfied until we're sure there are not going to be any future victims," that demands that power function differently.
Yeah. Our episode before this, which has not come out as of recording this, we talked about responses to abuse
mm-hmm.
and particularly like power abuse and church abuse and stuff. And because, you know, we've just got like this whole, we've got like a month of like forgiveness-y themed things. Like we did Vengeance and the Office of the Keys, which is the like power to forgive people. And
right.
It's a whole series that Matthew is like, yeah.
Yeah.
But part of what we talked about was in responding to abuse, it's not put the person in a different spot. It is the person who abused the power needs to be removed from the situations where they had the power to abuse. They are not responsible with that power, and so should not have that power. And we, by and large, don't do that. We think that people who have at some point become clergy or cops or whatever deserve all, like, that becomes the new standard for whatever else they do. They always get to fall back to at least being clergy or cop or whatever. And that is the power that gets abused. And if we don't take away that power to stop that abuse, it's never going to stop.
Right. Yeah. Right. And, part of the challenge is that so often the people making decisions about what happens to, at least in my universe, around clergy and definitely around policing. Mm-hmm. I do not know how it happens around clergy in your universe, but the people making the decisions about what will happen to this person who has caused abuse is their colleagues.
Yeah.
Who are like, but, you know,
like, what if
being a rabbi is the best thing in the entire world? This, yeah. You know, we should figure out how we can enable this person to continue being a rabbi no matter what. We could never take that away from them, mm-hmm. despite the fact that they have mm-hmm. insert list of, you know, horrific things. And it's hard.
Yeah.
It's complicated, but it is not neutral.
No. And that's the, like, again, it's who is being centered. Because mm-hmm. in all of those, I mean, it's a similar thing. There's, like, maybe bishops, which are used to be colleagues.
Right.
And are potential future colleagues if any pastors want to become bishops.
Right.
Right? So there's, like, those aspirational, like, everybody wants to be a millionaire, so we don't want to tax millionaires in case we ever become a millionaire thing.
Right.
But those are the people that are deciding what happens. Not always. Technically, we have a committee. Our denomination in particular is right now, like, trying to redo everything because we know that it's bad.
Yeah.
And people have said that and moved in the big assemblies to change it. But yeah.
Yeah. No, our denomination also, the conservative movement has, which is conservative, conserving Jewish tradition. It's not a political thing. It's sort of post-enlightenment, da-da-da-da-da. Don't need to get in the weeds. But
no, but it's helpful to, like, name, because we've had...
Yeah, people are like, you're conservative movement. Like, no, it's just people
I don't know about one, but at least most of the Jewish people that we've had, about half of whom are rabbis on the podcast, have been, like, one Orthodox rabbi, one Orthodox person, one conservative rabbi, one conservative person, and then one person who, I think there's only a conservative synagogue in that area, and so I would guess conservative. But it's just fascinating to me that, like, now that I'm thinking about it, because it's helpful, though, to name, because Christians are not going to be, like, unless they've done some sort of Jewish study, they're going to hear a conservative and be like, what?
Yeah, exactly.
But so I didn't know you were a conservative rabbi, and then I was like, oh, okay. Yeah, like, it makes sense.
You know.
It works.
Theologically, where I was when I was starting rabbinical school, and I don't know. That was the correct training for me, and in some ways I'm very much a conservative rabbi, and in some ways I'm very much not, and that's okay.
Yeah.
But I am on our gender and power committee, I am pleased to say, and have been involved somewhat in the work of revamping our structures. And there's an organization called Sacred Spaces. It's jewishsacredspaces.org, I think. That is incredible. Dr. Shira Berkovitz is just such a light in this work. And we're about to sort of hear our new plan for having better processes, because we need to center victims and not harm doers.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we've apologized.
Yes. Okay. So
is that it?
No. Well, no.
There's five,
so
right?
Confession. Mm-hmm. Confession. Start to change. Amends. Apology. And I will note that we can get into the whole back and forth about accepting apology and not and whatever, but I will note that the sentence, you need to forgive me so that I can be done with my repentance journey, is not something that exists in Judaism. It doesn't. Forgiveness is not relevant to the repentance process for us. Like, the person who was harmed has their whole forgiveness healing journey that is their business. Mm-hmm. And I, the harm doer, have my work that I have to do, which includes going back and apologizing up to 4 times with up to 3 different accountability teams to help check me to make sure that I'm, that, you know, my body language and what words I'm using, and to make sure things are landing. If the person keeps saying, like, no, no, this is not, no, thank you, I do not want. But eventually, if the person keeps saying no, I keep coming back. I am off the hook with apologizing to the person I harmed, and I'm free to go ask God for forgiveness on Yom Kippur. Because if I hurt somebody else and I haven't tried to make it right with them, I can't go to God on Yom Kippur and say, like, oh, I'm so sorry, right? God doesn't want to hear it. God is like, go away, go clean up your messes, come back later. But after you have sincerely and earnestly tried to apologize a number of times, then you're free to go ask God for forgiveness. But then you get to step 5, which is when you have the chance to do the thing again, and there will always be another opportunity to do the thing again, to play out your anger or your unresolved childhood wound, or to bury another complaint that's been sent to HR, or to create new and innovative horrors enacting white supremacy in our country, or whatever the thing is, when you have the chance to do it, you will make a different choice and take a different path. You will have become someone different who does different things. And I really believe that that will happen naturally and organically, because you have already done all of this deep work all along.
To go back.
Right? All of that. Ouch, and like oof of the confession and the deep stuff happening in the changing and the insights that happen with the amends and the apology, right? That both what's happening in your heart and what happens in any possible conversation or interaction that you're having with that person or community. By the time you have the chance to do the thing again, of course you wouldn't.
Okay. The other reading that is like really big on forgiveness is our Genesis reading, which is Genesis 50:15-21, which is this complicated forgiveness scene between Joseph and Joseph's brothers. And I'm curious how you, both as rabbi and as a person deeply immersed in forgiveness practice and education and spirituality, think about this passage, because again, it's a situation where we're like, at least the way it's translated in the NRSV, which is not necessarily the same translation as in the Torah. It is a tribute, like there is a line from Joseph of, what you intended for evil, God intended for good. And I usually think about it as not so much God intended, but like God instead used for good. And I don't know if it's actually the same word for both of those or not, but I'm curious how you navigate that, because that like attributes to God, it has the possibility of attributing harm as like from God or part of God's intent.
That is a good question. Oh yeah, okay, I see it. Tem chashavtem alai ra'a Elohim. There's a grammatical thing, and for a minute it looked like God was being put in the feminine, and that would have been great, but I don't think that's what's going on. God thought for me for good. Yeah, for bad. You intended me bad, evil, and God intended it for good. So to bring out about the, you know, survival of many people. But I think it's difficult to talk about this passage without talking about the Judah story beforehand and the whole Benjamin thing. So is it okay if we go back for a second?
Yes, that is totally fine. That doesn't happen in the lectionary, the Christian lectionary. It's so messed up and so gospel centric that we just like throw in the other readings.
Little bits of random desiccated passages. But yeah, this is the thing, is context matters. So we have this story in which Joseph is put in a pit, right? We've got Joseph is sent by his father to go visit his other brothers who are hanging out with the sheep. His brothers are jealous and they say, let's get rid of him. And who sells him out to the wandering, the traders is Judah, right? He literally sells him out.
And Judah's the oldest, right?
Second oldest.
Second oldest. Okay.
Right. Reuven is the oldest. And Reuven thinks that he's going to put them in the pit and then come back later and get him and save him. And the other brothers want to kill him. And Judah's like, ha, ha, let's sell him into slavery. That sounds like fun. We will make some cash, you know, get a new game for our Switch, whatever, right? And so Judah literally sells him out and sells him into Potiphar and into jail. And everything else that happens is, whether you want to say fate or fortune or narrative or who knows, but the bad stuff is Judah's fault.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have this interlude where Judah tries to also screw over his daughter-in-law, Tamar.
Yeah, and she gets him.
She gets him. She pulls some shenanigans in order to show him that he was not acting right. And he goes, oh, right. I was wrong. You were right.
Mm-hmm.
I was not okay. Then we are in a famine. The various brothers go down into Egypt, and then this weird, visor says to the brothers, I'm going to get you some grains, but you have to come back and bring the brother, mm-hmm. Benjamin, because I want to see him. I don't believe you. And it's like this whole strange situation, but they go back, and then there's not paying for it, and it's very confusing to them. And then the visor wants to hold Benjamin hostage after this whole stolen cup situation.
Mm-hmm.
And then what does Judah say? Do you remember?
I think he says something like, no, let him go, take me, or like he does not let or does not want to let Benjamin stay.
Right. He says, he says, Benjamin, let Benjamin go. Our father is particularly attached to Rachel's kids and we already lost one of them. Take me instead. Judah, the dude who sold Joseph out,
makes a different choice.
He sacrifices himself instead of the brother, right? He sacrifices mm-hmm. himself instead of his sibling. And that is what enables Joseph to forgive his brothers is because Judah has done tshuva. And it's my favorite tshuva story in the Torah, really.
Yeah.
And so because of that, that enables not only, and you remember, if you go through the story, you've got like Joseph is doing all these tests. He's like, can I trust them? Mm-hmm. He's still in high, he's pretending he's Egyptian. He's playing all these games with them. He's messing with their heads because he's not sure. And it's only after he sees that Judah's tshuva is real, that he's really done the repentance work, that the forgiveness happens and that Joseph can then reframe the narrative and say, you guys meant harm for me, but God meant good for me, right? That mm-hmm. And that we're now going to save all these people and I'm in this position to save all these people. And that, I think, is true of all victims. Mm-hmm. That as part of the healing process, they are enabled to make meaning in a different way.
Yeah.
Right? Like, why did you attack me? What was it about me that made you come and beat me up on the subway? Right? Mm-hmm. And then in the healing and in the reconciliation, they can come tell a different story about what happened that has their healing involved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is not the victim blaming of like, what was it about? Why did you do this to me? What did I do to deserve? But to then be like, okay, what is another thing? What else is? Yeah.
Right. And acknowledging the harm, but not even blaming them, right? It's not even, you tried to beat me up, but I have learned and grown and discovered my own resilience as a result of this horrible thing that you did to me, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right? Like, it's sort of naming the harm, but it's like, we're okay now. I'm going to find you land. We're all going to settle. We'll be friends.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an owning of his own strength through the harm.
Yeah, yeah. I love that. Our podcast is going to switch away from the lectionary after the end of this season because we will have done an entire 3-year lectionary cycle. And I'm excited. We haven't figured out exactly the format, but I'm excited to move away from the semi-randomness of how the lectionary compilers compiled things to be able to do more of this digging into the fuller stories of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Fun.
And now. For our, I don't have a good, we try to use new superlatives every episode, and it's not our most forgivingest segment, but it is our most delightful, in my opinion.
Most sensational, inspirational, celebrational.
Yes, celebrational. I like it. Our most celebrational segment.
Do 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 do
make a Muppets musical. So we occasionally remind our listeners, but I will remind them again because you are here. This segment came out of a Twitter conversation between you and Kay about Muppets musicalizing the Bible. And I don't remember all of the details, but from that came this segment. And so I am really excited for you to be here and participate in this segment of Let's Make a Muppets Musical, where we cast a token human or Muppets or both or all or whatever, some version of all of the things. And our definition of Muppets is very loose. So I think last 2 weeks ago, it included Bugs Bunny and Daffy. But it also mostly it includes Sesame Street characters and stuff. So I'm curious, if you were casting, for example, Genesis 50, who would you cast for Let's Make a Muppets Musical? Are there particular characters that you're like, oh, this has to be this Muppet, or this token human would be great with a cast of Muppets?
Oh my God, this is hard. So for those just tuning in, Genesis 50, we've got, you know, basically Jacob dies and Joseph flings himself on his father's face and is crying and kissing him. And then the physicians are like embalming him, which Jews do not do. We bury our dead in the ground and disintegrate and become part of the earth. Yeah. So, I mean, you know,
and we're in Egypt. And do it pretty quickly.
Yes, as quick as possible.
Yeah.
So, but we're in Egypt, so we're embalming. And, you know, basically we've got Joseph and some other folks that he's, you know, random miscellaneous Egyptians that he's talking to are our characters here, right?
And his brothers.
And miscellaneous brothers in the background.
Yeah, but not right, any specifically named brothers.
That's hard.
You could also do, like, the whole arc if that's easier.
It's true. So I sort of want to have, like, I don't know. Should we make, like, Rami Malek one of the Egyptian physicians?
We literally the other day cast Rami. I don't remember which one we cast him for, but we literally did that the other day. I love it. Rami Malek as one of the Egyptians.
You know, just like coming in with like a stethoscope looking concerned, you know.
And then everybody else is just the Muppets.
Yeah, and I would like, I sort of imagine the 12 brothers being like the most ridiculous mix of like two pigs in space, pigs, and like one of the Manamana guys, and you know, Sweetum.
I feel like the Yip Yips would also like just a couple of Yip Yips.
Yes. And oh Lord. Oh, the Swedish chef has to be one of the embalmers.
Oh yeah.
Let's see.
But then who's who else? Joseph.
Oh Lord. Who is the queerest Muppet?
I mean, there's a lot of
all of them. I don't know. Scooter? Gonzo?
I was also...
He's the genderqueerest Muppet. What were you saying?
I also think of, like, Fozzie Bear.
Yes. Yeah, maybe Fozzie.
Not necessarily in the, like, queer part, but in this, like, almost making it, the whole thing, a, like, trickster-style joke, right? Like,
oh,
you thought this was... You thought you were going to do the evil? Joke's on you, Waka Waka.
Like, Waka Waka, it is me. It is me, Joseph.
But there is, like, because Miss Piggy and Kermit frequently do drag.
Yeah, but I don't feel
that's
like...
not, yeah.
It's not the right energy somehow. But it's, yeah.
I do like Gonzo.
It's, Gonzo could do it, right? Yeah. Both like, hi guys, I have the dream, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I feel like Gonzo is canonically non-binary, so.
It sounds right. And Gonzo also comes with Gonzo the Great, right? Like, there is a, like.
You could totally picture Gonzo in the, like, Egyptian gear with the, like, eyeliner and, you know.
Yeah. That sounds like a good casting. I'm pretty happy with this.
Okay.
Now we just
need to... he's got a little more authority than Scooter. Scooter could do the tentative, like, hey guys, I had a dream, but I don't think he could rock the like visor of Egypt thing as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Okay.
Kay cast him the other week as the embodiment of righteousness because his role on the Muppets musical as stage manager is making sure everybody is in the right place at the right time and in right relationship to each other. I was like, this
that's
is
cute.
Delightful, and I love it.
That's really cute.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So, Danya, any other thoughts on life, the universe, and everything?
Let's see. You are the bomb diggity. This is so much fun. Let's see. On Repentance and Repair comes out in paperback now.
Yeah, nowish.
And
so we'll link to On Repentance and Repair. We usually link to the bookshop link for it.
And in which case I can furnish you with a 10% off.
Ooh. Yeah.
Yes. So in the show notes, you can find the link for 10% off, nice. Which means that you can super afford to get a copy for yourself, for the heads of the institutions that you're connected to, like the schools and the workplaces and everywhere that you want people to be doing good work
and
not hurting people, and your libraries. And you can maybe anonymously send copies to people that you secretly wish would read it. That's allowed. That's no awesome. One would know if you did that. Could send it straight from bookshop. And I have a newsletter that is weekly-ish called Life is a Sacred Text. Enter lifeisasacredtext.substack.com. It's spirituality and justice. It's basically, it's usually a sauntering through the Torah, talking through a usually justice lens. But we go other places too.
It's
mostly that.
Are your, like, this sounds weird, but your, like, archived tweets. Mm-hmm. So I have, like, links to, like, your Twitter thread on gender in Judaism and stuff that I, like, link to on a periodic basis. Are those on Substack? Are they anywhere, or are they gone to the winds like a mandala?
I mean, yeah, they on? So I have absconded from that platform,
mm-hmm.
because Nazis suck.
Yep.
And have not yet deleted my account, though it sounds like their terms of service are getting scarier and scarier. I might have to do that.
Yeah, I think.
But yeah, there's most of them are winding up on my Substack in form. So we just finished Leviticus, and so the a bunch of the queer stuff is already in mm-hmm. and through my big queer thread is up. Several of the big queer threads are up. My big reclamation of the word dyke and why Maimonides and 90s les pop are basically using the same tropes thesis.
Nice.
Is up. Yes.
Perfect.
Various social justice, it's like Judaism and labor justice and talking
abortion
about economic
justice.
And abortion justice is up several ways. Yeah. And there's also the more personal spiritual journey kind of stuff, because it is all interconnected. It is all one thing.
It's almost like life itself is a sacred text.
Don't tell.
We will definitely link to that as well in the episode description.
Yay.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being on our podcast, and I'm fairly certain we will have a Patreon episode.
Thank you so much for having me. This was delightful.
So again, I wish I could have been there for the interview, but I will have to insist on getting to take my turn with the Muppets, whether I was there or not. That's how
absolutely
this works.
Kay, absolutely.
Yes. So I loved Rabbi Danya's choices for the brothers with Joseph. I think that's wonderful. I'm also especially fond of the concept of the Swedish chef as an embalmer, and I wonder if there would have been extra Canopic jars, because he probably would have wound up taking out a few extra things, just because that's who he is. But I was thinking about it, and I love all of her choices, but we are not up to 12 brothers yet. And so there are a few extra spaces left. And I was thinking that really, if we're going to have the brothers as a truly random collection, they can't all really be from the Muppets. Like, we are a pan-Muppet, pan-Henson Muppet-like show. And so...
And we just did some, like, Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny. So we got a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was going to say that given how the brothers treated Joseph for so many years, it makes perfect sense for Oscar the Grouch to be one of the brothers, because they are awfully grouchy for a very long time in general. I don't know exactly which brother, like, we don't get enough character building of them as individuals in the Bible so much to get an idea of exactly which brother would have been Oscar, but one of them is definitely Oscar. And also, I think that at least one of them, just for pure hilarity and puppetry joy, needs to be one of the guys from Fraggle Rock. Because just in terms of both expanding the umbrella, which is what all about what we are about here at Nerds at Church, and also just the, I kind of wonder if maybe Benjamin would be the brother who's from Fraggle Rock, because Benjamin is the one who brings joy and love into this story so often. And that is what Fraggle Rock is all about.
Yeah, I like it. I like it.
Okay.
And now our readings. Our first reading is Genesis chapter 50, verses 15 through 21. Jacob has died, and Joseph's brothers decide that since they decided to try to kill him years before, this would be a great time to lie to him about how their father wanted Joseph to forgive them. An interpretation of this story.
You know.
Yeah. We already talked about this a little bit with Danya, but one of the themes in this passage is this concept of intentions. Like, the brothers' intentions had been for evil, and yet God still created good out of it. And it reminded me, so this is a spoiler for those of you who have not finished watching or watched the entirety of Star Wars Rebels, but towards like one of the last few episodes, Governor Price intends, the rebels are like attacking the fuel stuff on Lothal, and Governor Price has a shot to be able to hit them and intends to kill the rebels who are on top of one of the fuel cells. Yeah. And yeah, you see where this is going. And she tells them to shoot. And in doing so, she kills Kanan because Kanan protects everybody else and like takes that onto himself and does his Jedi magic thing. So she does what she intends. And yet in doing so, she destroys all the fuel stuff, which is what they were trying to do anyway. So they didn't realize it right away, and so they thought that, like, they had failed in their mission, and then they found out that they had not failed, and they were like, oh, she just took care of it for us. Great. Hmm. Like, they're all distracted by grief and things for Kanan, but, yeah.
Also, did no one tell her that all of the bad guys in Star Wars have terrible aim? Like, that is a semi-major plot point.
They actually, like, finally aimed well. It's just that it was such heavy fire, and they were...
Sure.
On top of the fuel cell.
Yeah.
There was awkward. No yet. Yeah, it was great.
Yeah. So as we jump into the verses, in verse 16, we read, "So they," that is the brothers, "approached Joseph, saying, 'Your father gave this instruction before he died.'" And here's the thing. We have no record of Jacob actually saying this. Like, there's a possibility he did. Sure, absolutely. But it's not in the Bible. And we're pretty big on the whole, if it's not in the Bible, then we can't count on it, you know, actually being there, kind of thing.
Right. And half the stuff that's in the Bible, we also can't count on.
Yeah, absolutely.
But if it's not in the Bible, we really don't know.
No. Then you're just making stuff up. And so it's very possible that the brothers are also just making stuff up and, you know, lying to Joseph about this because they would like to have Joseph not execute them when he finds out who they are. Awkward.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you know, we tried to kill you, but hey, Dad totally wouldn't want you to murder us, right? Because, yeah. And the thing is that an unexpected death can totally throw a family into chaos, especially if your family has, like, some kind of special legacy or power or something like that. Then the chaos just gets amplified and starts affecting other people's lives. For example, in the book The Goblin Emperor by Catherine Addison, Maya is the youngest son of an emperor, and he is estranged from the rest of his family because his dad hated his mom, long story, and he was raised completely separately and only saw his dad and brothers very briefly once at his mother's funeral, and that was it. Otherwise, there was no relationship at all. And when the dad and all three of his older brothers all die in an accident, which later on turns out not to be an accident, which is part of the plot, but essentially it looks like an accident. He becomes emperor, much to everyone's surprise, and apparently because, like, a lot of people seem to have forgotten that he existed at all. And so he starts learning a lot of things as he becomes emperor and starts growing into the role. He starts learning a lot of things about all of them after their deaths. Like, his father was not a good father, but actually he wasn't the worst emperor. Like, there were good things that he was trying to do, which makes him feel weird and uncomfortable once he starts finding that kind of thing out. And his brothers, two of them in particular, one of them more strongly, and then the other one may have just been younger and so didn't speak up as much. Two of them were on board with him coming to live with them and being more acknowledged and being a part of the family. But they couldn't overrule their dad, and so they were basically waiting for their dad to die, and then they would invite him to join them and to be certainly, you know, still the younger brother. And in imperial system, that means he would have less power and less money and so forth, but he would be acknowledged part of the family. And that really throws him for a loop, because he never had any idea that any of his siblings had positive feelings towards him. The third brother, it's not so much that he didn't want Maya to join them, it's just that he was, again, younger, and therefore Maya learns less about him because people weren't paying as much attention to him. So
That would be rather odd to all of a sudden learn good things about somebody that you did not like after they are dead.
Absolutely.
Or that you had a tough relationship with. And then in verse 19, Joseph, reassuring his brothers, says, "Do not be afraid. Am I in the place of God?" And I just finished Hijab Butch Blues by Lamia H, which everyone should read. It's fantastic. I did the audiobook version, and it's fantastic. One of the things that I really loved is it takes different surahs in the Quran and connects them to her life. It's a memoir, so it connects them to her life. And I think the last one that she does is the story of Joseph. And she talks about how Joseph, like, in taking the role of the grains, like taking over the grains and being in charge of that, makes himself indispensable. So, like, you may not be God per se, but you are indispensable in this system. You have made yourself indispensable as one who was previously literally thrown away. And I just thought that that was a really interesting take on it. But I also, like, loved hearing stories that I know fairly well told from the perspective that is in the Quran, and then, like, also interpreted, and it's queer. So, like, it's just a great book. Highly, highly, highly recommend.
Awesome. And then our second reading for this episode is from Romans chapter 14, verses 1 through 12. Paul instructs the church on how to live together when some have strong faith and others have weaker faith, and everyone has chosen different sets of rules for themselves.
Okay, we've got some Judgy McJudgerson going on in this one. Like,
to be fair,
off,
we kind of call Paul that a lot, but...
It's true, it's true. But, like... First off, vegetarianism is not for the weak. It may be for the anemic, and I may be the perfect example of that, but it's not for the weak. And you can just ask Daniel and his buddies that, because when they are in exile, they're vegetarian. And you know what? They do great. So, ha.
Yes. Also, I don't know that we know if you are, like, naturally anemic or if that is something that has been exacerbated by your vegetarianism. So I don't
also
think it's
fair,
for the
minor
anemic.
Detail.
I think maybe it you know, encourages anemia.
Detail.
Yes. Also, sometimes those turn out to be important. And so, speaking of which, as we jump into the verses, in verse 2 we read, "Some believe in eating anything, while the weak eat only vegetables." Okay, so this is one of those moments where if you don't know the cultural background to Paul's writing, you will understand this verse completely differently than if you do. And
or if
I
you
do
just
want to
have more fun
a...
with it, you will interpret it very differently, which is what I did.
Details, as you might say. Like, when Paul is saying, some believe in eating anything, well, that's not entirely true. Like, these people are not eating dirt or metal or, you know, other inedible
things.
Yeah, but please don't. I mean, I understand that there are, like, conditions and names for those conditions, and probably most of those names are based in Greek or something, because most of them are. But for the most part, these people aren't necessarily truly eating anything. But what Paul is saying is that in this time and place in Rome at this time, eating meat was complicated for Christians. The vast majority of meat in Rome at this time was sent to various Roman temples for various gods, where it was essentially dedicated to the god. Like, there's more technical information I could go into, but honestly, you don't care. That's fine. And it would be dedicated to the god, and then after that ritual, some of it would be set aside for the priests to eat, and then the rest of it would be sold. And the money from the sale of the meat would support the temple. So if you followed that god, buying the meat from that temple was basically another way of supporting the temple, and it was a religious act to both buy the meat and then eat it later. But if you were a Christian, and in Rome, if you were a Christian, you were probably also a convert from one of those other temples, there were basically two options. Either you could say to yourself, those other gods don't exist, or at least have no power over me, and so I can eat whatever I want, and buying the meat doesn't mean anything, it's just meat, it's not a religious act to me. Or, if, say, you're new to the Christian faith, or say there's some complicated family stuff going on, like maybe you weren't just immediately completely disowned and thrown out, maybe you're trying to have a relationship with some of your family members, and their way of doing that is like gifting you meat from the temples or something, because it's expensive. Maybe there's other issues going on, and you have some emotional stuff going on about all this, too. You might mm-hmm. just forego eating meat entirely, so as to not have to deal with those other temples at all. Like, it just makes life easier, right? And that can make a lot of sense for some people. And so early Christians in this time and place, a bunch of them would be vegetarian, not necessarily for their entire lives, but sometimes for several years, and some of them, yes, for the rest of their lives. But basically, finding meat to buy that hadn't gone through one of these temples first was somewhere between difficult and impossible at this time in Rome. Mm. And so being vegetarian was essentially a way of just not having to deal with that whole religious, emotional, historical mess. And that's a perfectly reasonable thing to do. And so when Paul is saying that those who only eat vegetables are weak, I think this might actually be a translation thing. I'm, again, not claiming to have been terribly good with foreign languages myself, but it's less that you're weak as that this is not a piece of your faith that you are interested in exercising at this moment, right? Like if we think of, I don't necessarily like to think of faith and exercise as being connected because that gives people a whole different set of body issues. But there are parts of our faith that we are interested in working on right now and other parts that we say to ourselves, you know, that's a little less important to me. And like, I can see how that matters on the whole, but maybe I don't have to work on that right this second.
Mm-hmm. And it's not possible to do everything all the time. So
no, absolutely. Because we're not God, as it turns out. What? And remembering that is helpful.
Joseph just said,
I know. And so, yeah. So basically, Paul is not saying that vegetarians are weak and will always be weak, as much as Emily loves to joke otherwise. But this is about saying that, you know, if this is not the piece of your Christian faith that you need to work on right now, that's okay. And go and eat vegetables like Daniel and his friends, and you'll be fine. And if you do want to eat meat, then that's true, that that's not actually you worshiping another god. And you're fine doing that, too.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, though. So as a vegetarian, I've kind of landed on the, like, 90% vegetarian, where I'm vegetarian 90% of the time. But I do have, like, exceptions primarily around hospitality, especially cultural hospitality. So if I am in a different culture from my own and the food there has, like, meat and like there's not an easy vegetarian thing,
sure,
then I'm more likely to eat meat as a like way of receiving hospitality.
I've had some interesting conversations about that with being clergy, and like if you go to the home of someone who doesn't have much and they offer you food, you eat what you are offered. It is not about whether you like it or not. It is about receiving the hospitality and being kind.
Yeah, and, like, there's a difference for, like, actual, like, medical and those sorts of dietary restrictions.
Yes.
But there is a, like, and then I did this one time, though, and I wasn't sure, like, they were making food, and we hadn't explicitly said that it was also for me, and so I hadn't said anything, and they had put meat in it, and I just ate it and, like, kind of ate around the meat, whatever. And, like, obviously some of it because it was the eggs and meat together. But then later they found out that I was vegetarian and they were like, oh, and I was like, no, it's okay. Like there was like, so we had to explain it some, but it's a weird balance, but yeah.
Well, and also it, I mean, even if it's not a full on medical restriction for you, it can cause some side effects. Cause like my aunt gave up eating mm-hmm. beef for 10 years at one point. And when she went back to eating beef, she had to slowly work her way into it so as to not have terrible digestive pyrotechnics. So.
Yeah. And that's part of why I'm at 90% is every once in a while I will eat meat just so that I don't like lose all of those enzymes and stuff in my body and can do it.
Sure.
If it happens accidentally or if I need to for like cultural hospitality or if I just need to for other reasons.
Yeah.
I also looked at verse 2, but then ended up really at verse 8, where Paul writes, if we live, we live to God, and if we die, we die to God. So then whether we live or whether we die, we are God's, is one of my favorite, absolute favorite hymns in the ELW, which is one of the main hymnals that we use in the ELCA. Mm-hmm. It is Pues Si Vivimos, which I think the English version is like, if we are living or when we are living or something.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, it is just beautiful. And it is a song that we sang at my ordination and that I definitely want sung at my funeral because it's just like this beautiful, like, no matter what, we are God's and God claims us.
Absolutely.
And then our gospel reading for this episode is Matthew chapter 18, verses 21 through 35. Jesus discusses forgiveness and what the refusal to forgive can lead to, especially among the powerless. So one of the themes in this passage was like, is the idea of pay it forward. I loved the book and the movie when they came out when I was a kid. They were fantastic. I also have like a really soft spot in my heart for Haley Joel Osment. But like the idea, right, is you are forgiven a huge amount, so you forgive others. Or somebody gives you a car when yours is broken down, somehow it leads to stopping all gang violence. I don't know. You know, too bad it doesn't solve, you know, the systemic problems, but hey, decreasing people dying by guns, that's a good thing.
Do no harm.
Yeah, but so I really love that this parable is, you know, the opposite of that. Of like, don't pay it forward and see what happens. And what happens is not great, Bob. Not great at all.
Yeah. And then in verse 31, we read, when his fellow slaves saw what had happened, they were greatly distressed, and they went and reported to their lord all that had taken place. Okay, so there is an episode of the original Leverage TV show called The White Rabbit Job, which, to be honest, I have probably not watched as much as I have watched the rest of the series. There are like two or three episodes that I am just less fond of, and this is one of them because this one is really trippy and also deals with some very deep emotional stuff. And so I don't necessarily rewatch this one every time I do a rewatch run through. But it involves the team trying to stop the shutdown of a factory by convincing the owner, sort of through his dreams, like really, this is kind of a take on the movie Inception, and apparently would have been recorded a couple of years after that movie came out. And basically, the employees of the factory are all convinced that something is wrong and they want to help fix it. And it's sort of this large group of people gets concerned and agitated and then tries to do something, much in the way that this verse is talking about. And they try to get the leverage team to help. And as it turns out, another reason I don't actually watch this episode very often is that it basically, this is another men will destroy entire companies instead of going to therapy story. And like, I have better things to do with my time. But it really is, like, I can say objectively it is a good episode. I just kind of bounce off of it. But that's okay.
That's also a little bit like men will lie about their father's dying wishes instead of going to therapy.
Yes. Again, wouldn't the Bible be such a different book if therapy was a thing?
Right. Yeah. I was looking at verse 34, and in verse 34, Jesus says, and in anger, the slave's master handed the slave over to be tortured until he should pay his entire debt. And a few things. One, torture is not effective. They've actually, like, done studies. I don't want to know how those studies, you know, happened, but like torture is not effective in interrogation, any of that. And torture is especially not effective in getting somebody to pay money that they don't have. Torturing them doesn't allow them to work to pay the money back.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's
kind of
weird.
Like the concept of debtor's prison. If you put someone in prison, how are they supposed to earn money to pay you back? They're not. That's actually kind of the point.
Exactly. And this person is in so much debt, right? Like, it's ridiculous. Yeah. It feels like payday loan style, massive amounts
or like
of
generations
debt.
Of debt.
Yeah.
Being piled on one person's head.
And, like, everybody in this parable just makes me uncomfortable because of, like, how much that that person had, and then, like, they're trying to get the debt from the other person, which, like, to be fair, just because their debt is forgiven doesn't mean they have money now.
Right.
So, like, they still don't have money, so trying to get the money from the other person, like, I kind of understand that perspective. But also, like, the whole thing is just extremely uncomfortable.
I will just say for the record that this is one of those Sundays I am always deeply tempted to just preach on Paul. Because Paul is interesting and also way less deeply creepy than this text. But
yeah. If only we didn't have a responsibility to preach on the tough stuff.
Yeah. Well, maybe I can figure out a way to do both, but we'll see. Yeah. Thanks for joining us. Catch us next time when we'll discuss nerdery connections to the scripture readings for the 17th Sunday after Pentecost. This podcast has been produced by us, Kay Roloff and Emily Ewing. For more fun, check us out on Twitter and Facebook at Nerds at Church, or contact us at nerdsatchurch@gmail.com.
And also, as of, like, last week, you can find us on Blue Sky as well. On Blue Sky, we are Nerds at Church. It's amazing. We get to just have the same handle for everything. So definitely, if you are over on the Blue Sky app, check us out over there, because we would love to engage with you on that app. Mm-hmm. And if you like what you've heard, rate us or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Facebook, or wherever you catch your podcasts. If you want access to our uncut guest episodes and interviews, live Q&As, and more, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/nerdsatchurch. It's cheaper than any amount of payday loans.
Absolutely.
Or the, like, probably the whole process of forgiveness and repair is also probably costs more than $5 a month.
Yeah, but we are not going to cost you serious emotional work.
No, we will delight you with it. And yeah, and you'll get the uncut version of this episode, because I'm 99% sure this is going to be a Patreon episode.
It's going to be amazing. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Also, let us know on Facebook, Blue Sky, or Twitter who you would cast for Let's Make a Muppets Musical for this episode.
As the ancient Christian said, Pax Vobiscum.